What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends, Larry Rifkin and John Krawczyk. John, I found him.
You found who?
I was looking everywhere, high and low.
Is this hither. Waldo you're looking for?
No. Dora the Explorer, no. Hither and yon, I turned things upside down and inside out, and you know what I found?
What'd you find?
A conservative millennial.
All right, well, they're out there.
Okay. But the message is one that I think most millennials will agree with, whether they're conservative, moderate, or more liberal. John, are you a fan of like all these Ocean's films, Ocean 9, Ocean 11, all of these?
I like the original one. I haven't really watched the new ones.
But do you like all these great heists? I mean, do they excite you?
Like I said, the first one was good with all the with Dean Martin, and that was a great film.
Yeah.
Was it Frank?
Yeah,
Sinatra?
That was way back when.
That was a great film.
Oceans. I forgot what that was.
Oceans 11 or Oceans
1, 11, 9, 15.
But I mean, it was
four great. And a half.
I haven't watched the new Oceans films, but you know, I've watched other heist films.
Okay, so you like that?
Yeah.
I mean, the notion. For example, there was that great art heist in Boston. I don't think they've ever figured out who did that.
No.
That wonderful private museum, and there was a guy in our state of Connecticut who was implicated.
They thought
he had put it in his yard or something. I don't know. Okay, so the whole idea of a heist. Well,
makes for a good story.
It does. Well, the book is called The Theft of a Decade by Joseph Sternberg. And Joseph thinks that he's got a story that can beat all of those stories that have been fictionalized with all these great characters, great robberies and heists, or even the real ones by a long stretch. Now, his basic argument, John, is this, that few thefts in history can match what baby boomers have done to the millennials since 2008. So a lot of the issues that he raises were the response of decision makers after the financial collapse of 2008. Now, I think there are many of us who would say, well, wait a minute. Why that period? Because they kind of saved us from a total meltdown. Why was that the moment in time when we really put a burden on the back of millennials, baby boomers? It kind of has to be explained.
For that.
What's that?
Because we paid for that.
Well, did we?
Well, we borrowed for it.
Thank you. And that bill is due, not at any time soon, but it's due.
We left the millennials a huge bill.
Well, we left them a lot of messes, a bag of bricks. I mean, like this debt. We urbanized all their jobs, and we sent them into areas where the cost of housing is skyrocketing.
Great leadership to come on line here. And
yeah, well, you can keep waiting, John. They have a lot of uncertainty, let's be honest about it, into the future, thanks to these incredible changes in our economy and technology. So we've left them with a lot of problems to be solved.
Endless wars. I mean, we've left them with a lot of stuff,
exactly.
A lot of baggage.
But, you know, this book has gotten a lot of reaction from many quarters as to whether his analysis is the traditional analysis of the problems we've left them with, like college debt, you know, skyrocketing costs of housing and all that. So the interesting thing that he did is he looked at it from the standpoint of a third way. And he said the problem is that Republicans and Democrats have continually sought a third way in terms of solving our problems. Between getting the state really
the
involved.
The right way, the wrong way, and the third way.
and the third way. No, between the state really getting involved and letting the market run free. And so between those two, we've always tried to straddle. And are we doing a good job, or are we really bringing these millennials into a point where it's going to be very difficult for them to crawl out of the hole that we've dug for them? So I think it's a really fascinating topic. You may agree, you may disagree with some of his conclusions, but they are well worth your time. Again, the book is called The Theft of a Decade: How the Baby Boomers Stole the Millennials' Economic Future. What was that, John?
I buried that in my backyard.
You did?
Yeah.
Okay. He's got a piece of art back there that was done by, I think it was Thomas Kincaid. Didn't I see that at a mall one day? Remember when Thomas Kincaid was the big art connoisseur, and everybody was buying Thomas Kincaid?
Yeah, they had all that Christmas stuff that was Thomas Kincaid.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. How did we get into that? I don't know. We better get back
to our topic today.
Okay.
The theft of their decade.
Absolutely. Joseph Sternberg is with us today on America Trends.
Joseph Sternberg is with us. He's written a book called The Theft of a Decade: How the Baby Boomers Stole the Millennials' Economic Future. Now, I know you're a millennial, correct, Joseph?
Yes, an older millennial, born in 1982.
All right, exactly the date that our son was born. So I've got one of those older millennials, and as you can imagine, I'm a baby boomer, and I'm hearing this a lot lately. And in many ways, I do agree that we've made some decisions that are prejudicing the future of that generation. But just so people understand what we're talking about, why don't you define baby boomers and then millennials?
Okay, so the baby boomers are actually the easy part of this. You are a baby boomer if you were born between 1946 and 1964. Those are the commonly identified starting and ending points for that generation. And it really was an unusual generation in American history. It was the product of an unusual fertility spike. The baby boomers' mothers each had more children on average than women had had in the immediately prior generations. You had this huge cohort that was coming online in the economy when the American economy was particularly strong in the 50s and 60s when the boomers were growing up, partly because you had all of these families with boomers in them who were young families moving out into the suburbs, all of the consumption that that entailed. Now, the millennials are the boomers' children, and there's actually a harder time identifying who we are. The definition that I use most often in the book is people who were born between around 1981 and 1996. That's right around the cohort that are the children of the boomers, so there are a lot of millennials, too, anywhere between 71 and 80 million, depending on exactly how you count. But not quite the result of the same kind of fertility spike that had produced the boomers. So we end up with this odd situation where you have these two very large cohorts jostling around together in America right now, about the same size and, as I point out in the book, not often with the same economic interests.
Now, The Theft of a Decade, just explain why that title per se, because it's really the theft perhaps of one generation to another, and maybe without intent, baby boomers, or many of us, have left some spoils on the doorstep of you millennials. But why call it the theft of a decade?
Yeah, this was really the heart of the question I was trying to answer with the book, which was a form of who's right. I mean, we have these odd economic arguments in America right now where it's almost as if the boomers and the millennials are talking past each other. So the millennials will say, well, hey, we're having trouble getting established in the job market. We're having trouble climbing onto the property ladder. We're laboring under the burden of $1.6 trillion of student debt that we're not sure we'll ever be able to repay. We're staring down the barrel of all of the fiscal demands that the boomers will place on old age entitlements like Social Security and Medicare. Millennials say, yeah, give us a break. It's really tough for us. Well, the boomers look at millennials and say, you kids have never had it so good. We're the generation that has Google to do our homework for us. We can hail a cab with Uber before we even have to step out to the curb in the rain. You have all of these modern conveniences. This whole avocado toast phenomenon I talk about a little bit in the book, where boomers will say, well, how can you millennials, you young whippersnappers, complain about not being able to afford a house when you're blowing all of your money on $20 avocado toast for brunch on a Saturday morning instead of saving for your down payment. Well, the story I'm telling in the book is that actually the millennials are right in that argument, that things are difficult for millennials economically in a way that wasn't the case for the boomers. Part of this is a result of longer-term trends, bad decisions that the boomers started making about economic policy going back to the 90s even, and certainly in the run-up to the crisis. But the particular decade I focus on and where I think that the real generational theft happened here is the decade after the 2007-2008 financial crisis and the Great Recession. Because that, first off, it was the deepest recession America had suffered since the Great Depression in the 20s and 30s. It hit millennials at a particularly vulnerable point in our economic lives because it landed right as millennials, the bulk of us, were entering the workforce for the first time, which was always a particularly dangerous time for someone to have to live through a recession. And boomers compounded those problems by making a series of bad policy choices that delayed the recovery in ways that millennials are going to have to repay for a long time. We're going to have to work much harder to make up the ground that we lost in that decade. So that's really the kind of theft that I'm talking about. It was those policy mistakes that made it difficult for the American economy to recover quickly enough to get this enormous millennial cohort back on track at that vulnerable point in our economic life cycle.
Well, two historical points. Obviously, and you do point it out, that many of us who are baby boomers, we started out at a pretty terrible time with gas prices spiking, stagflation, 17-18% interest rate on home mortgages. So we didn't have it all that good ourselves. And our parents really had very little that they could do for us, whereas today I think there are a lot of boomers in a position to at least soften the blow of what it is many millennials are experiencing. I know that we gave our daughter a loan to pay off her master's degree. So there are many things that we can do. Having said that, the other thing that I want to ask you about, I know you're questioning many of the decisions that were made in the wake of the financial crisis. However, if we go back to Herbert Hoover and 1929 and what that led to in terms of not doing anything, and yet Bernanke and Paulson and the others taking extraordinary measures such that there are a lot of people who don't look back at 2008 and 9 with the horror that it really demands because they never really saw the full brunt of what it was that was occurring at that moment because, well, they took extraordinary measures to arrest it.
Absolutely. So, I don't want to give people the impression that I am completely unsympathetic to the baby boomers. I'm just mostly unsympathetic to them. I mean, you raise exactly a point that I actually talk about at some length in the book because I concluded as I was researching this book, and this surprised me a little bit. I started out expecting that it was going to be a very simple instance of generational warfare going on here, and what I discovered is no, that's not true. The baby boomers did experience a series of big economic transformations during their own life cycle, which I think really actually shaped a lot of the mistakes that the boomer generation has made that are now impacting their millennial children so seriously. The kind of transformation that was going on, certainly the economic security that the baby boomers grew up with in the 50s and 60s when they were children, really started to break down in important ways in the 70s. And so you did have very visible problems like the stagflation, the gas lines, the skyrocketing interest rates to try to recover from that. You also had America coming under much greater competitive pressure as the West German and Japanese economies were coming back online after a long period of rebuilding after the war. All of these were forces that really affected the boomers in a big way. Now, the problem with this is that as bad as the 70s were, it still wasn't as bad as what we experienced in the Great Recession. The periods of high unemployment weren't as long as it took for the American economy to recover after 2008. When you had the situation where unemployment rates were very high, and they actually stayed quite high for a long time, they drifted down only very slowly. You know, certainly the depth of the contraction in the Great Recession was more serious. Now, you know, one of the things I point out is that, you know, it's certainly true that we had learned lessons from the Great Depression. And I do, you know, give the policymakers in, you know, the 2007 to 2009 some credit for the firefighting that they did. You know, I think that certainly some of the, and this is another surprise that I came across, particularly writing as a conservative, some of the most controversial policy interventions from that era, things like TARP or, you know, Federal Reserve measures that were oriented toward stabilizing the financial system in the depth of the panic, a lot of that stuff actually worked. And it is absolutely right to say that that was, you know, in the end, it turned out to be a policy success, that it staved off a total financial collapse that would have been absolutely ruinous. The problem is all of the things that came after. The fact that we continued fighting the fire of the financial crisis with monetary policy long after the crisis, long after the fire was actually out. And I talk a lot about some of the effects of that on the economy that have particularly affected millennials. I think a bunch of the other policy measures that were introduced in that era to try to get us over the hump of the Great Recession that weren't oriented toward that financial firefighting that was so important, and that ended up having much more serious unintended consequences for the economy.
This is Joseph Sternberg. He's written the book, The Theft of a Decade, How the Baby Boomers Stole the Millennials' Economic Future. I read where you said that the problem has been a third way between state intervention and market freedom. And you write, it is a dysfunctional system that encourages corruption and rigs the game in favor of big business. When I watched the Democratic debate last night, you sounded a lot in that like Elizabeth Warren.
So now I want to be clear, I am writing from a, you know, free market conservative standpoint, and I think that it's actually important for people on the political right to have this kind of discussion, because one of the things I get into a bit in the book is the fact that baby boomers fell into this habit, which, you know, depending, you know, various times in the 90s, you might have Clinton talking about the New Democrats. It showed up as compassionate conservatism in the early 2000s under George W. Bush. The basic thrust of it was that if you look at the actual policies that were implemented during the times that the boomers had been running the government in the U.S., they've actually traveled in a very narrow lane. And the idea was that they recognized that you need to have a large market component of the economy that has the productive power to keep creating the jobs, the wage gains, that sort of thing. But the boomers also were trying to leverage that in service of what they thought of as the protective power of the state, the you know, ability to pull the levers in the market and to regulate the market in such a way that you could achieve certain policy aims. That might show up in terms of policies in the 90s, where the Clinton administration was really trying to encourage a lot of investment in IT and in tech, because they believed that that was the economic way of the future. It showed up in the early 2000s with a lot of Bush-era policies that were really oriented toward trying to push people into home ownership by pulling levers in the market to encourage that. You know, the problem is that, that model has broken down. You end up without enough productive power from the market, and at the same time, you know, you end up with a state that isn't able to manage the distortions that you end up creating from that. So I do have some limited sympathy for politicians who want to talk about those issues. And in fact, I argue in the book that one of the reasons right now millennial voters seem to be gravitating toward politicians further on the left is because those politicians, whether it's Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders or Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, are the ones who are offering a way out of that very narrow boomer lane of policymaking. Now, someone needs to point out to those people, though, that if you go down that road of more government intervention to try to solve all of these problems, instead of taking the path of veering in the direction of more market as a solution, you're actually going to entrench a lot of these distortions. And so I, you know, one plea that I would make to my fellow millennials is to be careful about going down that road, because as soon as you start relying too heavily on that kind of intervention in the economy. You know, regulation, intervention always favors insiders over outsiders. Young people are the ultimate outsiders in any economy. And so I think that it's helpful if we can kind of talk about these issues, understand what happened here. That might actually make it easier for people on the political right to engage in some of these discussions.
It's interesting, in the first chapter of the book, you say that we, the baby boomers, have bequeathed a better health standard due to required immunizations and airbags in cars. But you think that less regulation in finance might lead to a healthier economy. Is that really the case, or can either Democrats or Republicans say that they can keep their hands out of economic policy? For example, we've got President Trump, who likes to think of himself as a regulation cutter, and yet here he's telling Jerome Powell how to run the Federal Reserve, and during a period of low inflation and what he calls the greatest economy, and you'll have to explain how he could say that in the midst of all that we're discussing and the impacts on millennials, he wants to see interest rates back down near zero or below. So where does all this stand? Who's on what side? It's very confusing.
Well, absolutely. And imagine how millennials feel, who are kind of in the position of just having to, first off, as a first order problem, argue that millennials actually are facing a crisis. Still, even with the unemployment rate finally hitting historical lows, certainly millennials feel a sense of urgency about these problems. Because even if the economy is good now, there's a lot of research that suggests that if you have graduated into the labor market during a recession, it actually takes you a long time to recover from that. It takes you a long time to recover from the fact that it took you years to get into your first entry-level job. It takes a long time to recover from the depressed earnings that you've experienced, as you haven't been able to job hop as quickly as young people traditionally would to try to catapult themselves up the salary ladder. It's going to take millennials years to repay a lot of the student debt that we racked up for a lot of millennials who went to school as a form of holding tank if the job market wasn't working. You know, a lot of people would go into very expensive further education in the hope that it would improve their job prospects, only to discover when they graduated that it might not right away. So there is a sense of urgency about this. And one of the things I point to in the book is that right now, I don't actually think that either party is engaging fully with these issues. I mean, you do have a lot of general talk on the left about, certainly issues like inequality or fairness. I mean, certainly as we're recording this, Bernie Sanders has just written a op-ed for the Wall Street Journal where he talks about some of the need to deal with more inequality issues. But, you know, they aren't really thinking about this from a generational perspective. They aren't thinking about the kinds of inequality or, you know, the kind of economic distortion that particularly affects millennials. I think that certainly the conservative side has yet to engage with that, because the nominal leader of the Republican Party right now, President Trump, is actually the ultra-boomer president. A lot of his rhetoric on trade issues, a lot of his rhetoric on immigration, a lot of his rhetoric on low interest rates certainly reflects boomer concerns and, you know, longtime boomer policy preoccupations much more than it reflects anything that affects younger voters, millennials. So, you know, the first challenge that we face is going to be just, launching a serious discussion about what all of the precise, you know, the precise nature of the problem that we're facing. And then it is absolutely true that if you're going to argue for the free market solution, you're always going to have to grapple with the political economy problem that the politicians just can't keep their hands off. I think that that is also a debate that millennials are going to have to engage.
You also equate the problem to how America thinks about investment and the way that we have made investment so cheap that investment in labor or personnel or people and their development and training has really taken a back seat. And help us to understand that along with automation, AI, where you see all of these things converging.
Okay, this is really the heart of the story that I tell about the labor market. It's that somewhere along the line in the past 30 or 40 years, the way that the American economy invests has really broken down. And the other thing that's broken down as a result of that is productivity growth, which is so crucial to producing good jobs and wage gains for workers over time. Now, you know, this is certainly a transition that started in the 70s. In fact, this was one of the original causes of some of the economic traumas that the boomers faced for, you know, reasons that are still under debate. It seems that in the late 60s, early 70s, you know, the rate at which businesses would invest in expanding their businesses or invest in new technologies that would boost the productivity of their workers slowed down. The boomers never quite came up with a good answer to that problem. And in fact, I think a lot of the answer that they tried to come up with would involve enlisting the government to try to guide investment in various industries that they thought were going to be the high productivity job creators of the future. You know, again, you could see this in the 90s with the Clinton era enthusiasm for the computer. You could see it in the 2000s where the Bush administration thought that pushing people into home ownership, creating an ownership society would be the thing that would stimulate more investment more broadly. You could see it with the Obama era enthusiasm for green energy as the way of the future. The problem is that none of these things have ever quite unlocked the right kinds of investment in the economy. They've never unlocked broad enough investment across a range of industries. And you know, economists still aren't entirely sure about why that is. I think that one of the problems that the boomers ran into is that the harder they tried to guide investment toward the sectors of the economy that they thought would be the most productive, the more other avenues for investment they were cutting off. So they have ended up creating an economy where if you happen to have a skill set that makes you really good at designing a smartphone app or a tech startup, this is a terrific time to be alive. It's never been easier for you to get venture capital funding to launch your business. But if you have an entrepreneurial idea to manufacture something, it's very difficult to do that in America right now. It's very expensive to hire a workforce. It's very expensive to manage all of the environmental regulations that you have to deal with for a manufacturing business. Just on down the line, it becomes so much more difficult to do that kind of productive investment. And you know, so that's one of the distortions that I look at, you know, a fair bit in the book, because I think that we really do need to think about how can we open more opportunities for more job creation and more industries that would benefit more people. And you know, I think if you think about it that way, you shouldn't necessarily be afraid of automation, because you know, certainly technological investment can be and historically has been a key to creating a more productive workforce that can generate more output, that can you know, be worth higher wages. I think that the problem is going to be if you are steering money into only certain kinds of technologies where you're cutting off a bunch of other opportunities for investments that could make more workers more productive, that's going to create the sort of you know, distortion that really makes people worry, and I think often for good reason.
Joseph Sternberg is with us on America Trends, The Theft of a Decade. You say that the fatal flaw and greatest economic sin was, quote, failing to recognize soon that their fixes, meaning the baby boomers, weren't truly working as hoped. Now, anytime we say that, then they say, well, let's try something else. So we see a lot of training programs now for older workers, younger workers, to get them into manufacturing, advanced manufacturing, and the like. We also see that there are so many companies today that have bowed out of the benefits programs that we, the baby boomers, benefited from. And if you go back, as you said, perhaps to the late 70s, a lot of what was gained between the 30s and the 70s in terms of a secure and really welcoming workplace, that has all changed. And we have, what, 50% of you millennials in a gig economy, which basically means you're a freelancer. You're an independent contractor. You're on your own, buddy. So put all of that together for us.
Well, the gig economy I thought was absolutely fascinating because I actually do buy an argument that it's a symptom that something has gone wrong. And I think the way to think about this is to recount a conversation I had recently with a friend of mine about my age, so also an older millennial, who is running a small company in the Washington area, you know, a service providing firm. You know, they don't manufacture anything. Their output is more in terms of the service. And he was describing his workforce, and he said that, you know, really a lot of his workers would technically count as part of the gig economy because he hires them as independent contractors on a per job basis, you know, because that's what he can afford to do. And he was telling me that he would actually be happier if he could afford to bring those workers on as salaried employees and then be able to invest more of his time in training them over time to increase their productivity on the job to help his own business. But it's prohibitively expensive to do that because, you know, any people who are listening to this who run their own small businesses will understand that as soon as you bring on a salaried employee, the tax burdens associated with that are going to go up. You know, the potential regulatory compliance burdens of that are going to go up, particularly if you have a workforce spread across a couple of states. You know, depending on the precise size of your company, your various healthcare requirements that you might face, that is all going to become much more expensive. It's this sort of thing that you know, makes it difficult, actually, for companies to invest in their workers. And, you know, this is something I think that we need to be clear on. I mean, the impression that I often get talking to entrepreneurs, to people who are in the business world, is that they do want to invest in their workforce. They want to be able to invest in training their workforce in ways that will increase productivity. They want to be able to invest in new equipment for people to be able to keep up their productivity that would be good both for the company and for the worker. It's just that it becomes so difficult to do that for all of these regulatory or tax reasons. And, you know, that kind of pushes people into less stable employment as a result. And, you know, this is a phenomenon that I talk about a bit in the book because, you know, if you go back in economic history, it used to be, certainly early in the 20th century, that companies did invest in workers in that way. In fact, the whole origin of the employer-provided pension was a form of investing in workers as a way to try to retain them. And it was precisely because that was an era when workers were becoming much more productive, and so the companies really had an interest in investing in the workforce. Somehow that mindset has broken down, and I think that it's not because the business world doesn't want to do that. It's because it's difficult for them to do that financially. And, you know, we really need to talk about that. And this gets to the a key distinction that I talk about in the book in terms of some of these economic security aspects, whether it's the pension plan or whether it's the health insurance that the company offers, you know, whether it's the stability of having the long-term employment, whether it's the level of the wage. I think a key mistake that the boomers made was they thought that the economic security of the 50s and 60s, they grew up watching their parents enjoy. Mm-hmm. They thought of those trappings of security as an input into the economy. They thought, well, if you have the union, that is the thing that will help protect the interests of the workers. They thought, you know, if you have the health insurance, that is the thing that will give you security. But that was all actually an output of an economy where investment and productivity growth were very high. I argue that the thing that gave trade unions their power in that era was the fact that investment and productivity were so high that the workers themselves were much more productive, and that gives workers more leverage in the economy you know, when they are negotiating for salary or benefits with their employer. I think the real danger is that boomer policymakers have always thought of these things as inputs. So you have this conversation about how if we increase the minimum wage dramatically, say to $15 an hour, that increase in the minimum wage is the thing that will force companies to invest in boosting the productivity of their workers so that then the worker is productive enough to warrant that kind of a wage level. I think that that kind of thinking is backwards. I think that we need to think about what are the things that we do that increase the investment and the productivity, and then the economic security will flow from that. And so this is really a key mistake that I think that the boomers have been making. And to judge by a lot of the debates on the presidential stage right now, it's a mistake that a lot of boomer politicians are still making.
It's interesting because you lowered the boom on the baby boomers, but Lyman Stone, in a piece in The Atlantic, and he was a guest on our podcast recently on another topic about the declining birth rates, But he wrote, "The boomers ruined everything. The mistakes of the past are fast creating a crisis for younger Americans." And he talked about the fact that we have squeezed the dynamism out of so many things in America. He said, "We have required you folks to get more licenses and certification than is necessary, that we've really hurt you in the housing market with land use policies." And he went on to a whole host of things that he thinks we have done wrong. And he says, "Laws and rules requiring workers to have these special licenses, degrees, or certificates to work have proliferated. And while much of this rise came before boomers were politically active, instead of reversing the trend, we've extended it." So, I mean, he extends it into many other areas. So I want you to comment, as I'm sure you've read his piece, and then the debt that we're leaving you. Talk to that, too.
Okay, well, you know, I thought that that was a terrific essay in The Atlantic that Lyman wrote, and I think that he covers a few special cases of issues that I do touch on in the book, things like the zoning regulations, or, you know, I think that he does a public service by focusing on this occupational licensure issue. I think that my main argument about that is that the story is so much bigger. And in fact, by understanding that the story is bigger than these few particular policy fixes that he proposes on zoning laws or occupational licensure, it actually answers a couple things that might be baffling about millennials if you only go through a relatively narrow lens. So, for example, if you want to argue that the problem with the boomers is that they've always regulated with far too heavy a hand, it might initially seem kind of surprising that then the millennial rebellion against that is to vote for a bunch of socialist politicians. But, you know, what I argue in the book is that, no, the boomer approach was much more complicated than that. What was actually going on in the boomer era, because remember, I mean, the boomers came of age voting for Ronald Reagan and the supply-side revolution in the 80s and the deregulation there. You know, boomers only really embraced Bill Clinton after he started promising that the era of big government was over. And, you know, the boomers also produced George W. Bush and the Ownership Society. So I don't think that you can automatically argue that the boomer instinct was always and everywhere to overregulate everything. I think that their real error was to try to regulate some things while not focusing on the interactions that could develop the distortions that could happen between the parts of the economy that they deregulated and the other parts of the economy where they were increasingly regulating very heavily. And if you think about that, and if you understand this narrow policy lane I was talking about a few minutes ago in that way, then you start understanding why it is that the millennials haven't rebelled against the overregulation part of the boomer thing necessarily by moving in a market direction. You understand why it could make sense to the millennials initially that maybe they want to look anew at the market part of that. And then you also understand how it is that politicians or commentators who are much more on the free market side of these things can start pushing back against that. I think my main thought on that kind of issue is, you know, don't go for the capillary. You really have to go for the jugular on a lot of these issues.
And what about the debt that we're leaving behind? I have talked many times to Lawrence Kotlikoff, and he's a liberal economist. He says that we're really looking at a fiscal gap of $200 trillion, not $20 trillion as it relates to public debt. How do you look at that issue?
So Lawrence Kotlikoff has done some fascinating work, some of which I quote in the book, to do with this concept of generational accounting. And the idea is that you can't just look at the total amount of government debt that is on the books today. You also have to add up what is the future value of debt service, of having to pay interest on that debt, what is the future value of all of the payments that people who are alive today are going to draw out of the system in the form of entitlements, and then look at what are the future contributions of people who are alive today into the system that they'll be drawing out from eventually. And you discover that you have these huge fiscal gaps where the promises that politicians have made to people, and particularly that the boomers made to themselves, are completely unrealistic in terms of the ability to pay for them. And the way I talk about this in the book is that, you know, you have to understand that the boomers decided that they were prepared to pay about 20 to 23% of annual GDP in taxes. That's about the amount of the productive economy that the government collects in, you know, various forms each year. And yet, if we want to meet these entitlement burdens in the future, millennials are going to have to be prepared to contribute a much higher proportion of our annual productive output to the government in order to get it all to work out. That implies that our, you know, effective tax rates are going to have to be much higher than what the boomers were prepared to pay to fund the boomers' own benefits.
Oh, absolutely.
And, you know, well, and I think that there's a fascinating political point here, which is the dog that hasn't started barking yet. Because, you know, we are now paying a lot of attention to millennials getting elected to Congress. You know, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, you have Ilhan Omar on the left. You have people like Mike Gallagher from Wisconsin on the right getting elected as a Republican millennial. So clearly millennials are reaching a point in our political lives where we'll start to be taking more control of politics. And you ask yourself, what is the greatest power that a member of Congress has? The power of the purse. That's how they exercise control, by making decisions about what money to spend. And yet, as millennials come into Congress, we're inheriting a government where, you know, up to three-quarters of federal spending operates on autopilot, you know, whether it's to various entitlement programs, or to other, you know, forms of spending that the boomers have set up and then have tried to insulate from congressional control. So, you know, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's big thing is the Green New Deal, and that's going to be super expensive if it ever comes to pass. I mean, millennial politicians on the left might decide that they want to invest a lot of public resources in forgiving student loans. I mean, we can argue about whether those policies are wise or not. The reality is that they may end up being a millennial political priority. But where is the money going to come from? I think the reality for millennials in both the left and the right is going to be that if we want an opportunity to enact any of our policy priorities, we're going to have to do entitlement reform first, because that's the only way to free up all of the resources that we're going to need.
Well, Paul Ryan left, and nobody else is talking about it right now. I just want to thank you for talking about it. Also, folks, if you read the book, and it is really fascinating, Joseph says in the book that there's a lot more economic transformation that's lurking beneath the numbers than meets the eye. So there's a lot going on that this book does address, and you'll have to read it. We only have a certain amount of time with him. The Theft of a Decade, How the Baby Boomers Stole the Millennials' Economic Future. Joseph, thank you for being with us today on America Trends.
Well, thanks for having me on.
All right. Great job. Thank you. And we will let you know when we're going to post. We're a little bit ahead, because that's kind of me. I don't know where this boomer got that anal retentive thing. But so you'll be we'll probably be posting you in September. Okay.
Okay.
And we'll let you know, we'll give you all the links, and we're active on social media, and if you can really share and get the word out, we'd appreciate it.
Okay, terrific. Well, look, thank you very much for giving me this opportunity, and I love doing this sort of podcasting format, because it just gives you more time than a 3 or 5 minute media hit to actually dig in, so it's always...
Oh, believe me, I know. I mean, I was doing a talk show for the last 7 years. Found myself, I'm much more of a moderate liberal, found myself way out of step when I had a Trump impersonator on, and my audience didn't get it. Now I was head of programming for Connecticut Public Television for almost 27 years. So I come out of a background where we try to do things in a little bit longer form. So anyway, it was really a pleasure, and I look forward to posting this and getting the word out, okay?
Great. Well, thanks very much.
America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.